desolate and the wild animals too numerous for you. Little by little, I will drive them out before you until you have increased enough to take possession of the land. Exodus chapter 23, verses 29 to 30. God's directive displayed his infinite wisdom and vision for their future. While they were tired and weary of waiting and wanting to rush right in, God knew they couldn't yet manage all that real estate. He knew that in their current condition, the land they desperately wanted, the land he had promised them, had the power to destroy them. So he showed them how to achieve their mutual goal, little by little. They needed to grow stronger first, so he put them on a strength training plan. In the process, he prepared the land for them and prepared them for the land. Can you relate at all to the mindset of the ancient Israelites? Have you ever wanted to rush headlong into whatever it was you felt called by God to do? If so, welcome to the club. Most of us want our destiny on demand. We want all of God's promises to be yes and amen and now. But that's not how God's little by little method works. God is process oriented. Consider just a few other areas of life where we see this principle very clearly. Little by little, we lose weight and build muscle. Get debt free by discipline and delayed gratification. Acquire our education and qualifications. Build trust in relationships. Write books. And the list could go on. Virtually everything in human experience is accomplished little by little. That's how God works, little by little. When we began A21 in 2008 in Sydney and Thessaloniki, we had one staff member and a handful of volunteers. In the first few months of operation, we had rescued one girl and put one trafficker in jail. We could have grown discouraged and quit before we really gained any traction. But God says not to despise small beginnings. So we kept going, and we began to succeed little by little. Over the next several years, our rescue numbers increased, and we established our aftercare programs. We grew stronger. As I write, A21 now has 13 offices and more than 200 team members in 12 countries. We have rescued hundreds of men, women, and children. We've warned hundreds of thousands of refugees about the dangers of trafficking in the camps in Greece. Our recent Walks for Freedom happened in 400 cities, 50 countries, and involved tens of thousands of people walking. Our public awareness campaigns warning about trafficking are displayed on buses, in airport terminals, and throughout public venues in multiple countries. We've helped young rescued women finish high school and then sent them on to college. And for the first time in our 10 years of rescues, one of these survivors joined our team as a staff member. She wanted to give back by helping other young women step into freedom and healing from the pain they have experienced. But her process, from being rescued to stepping into our offices as a full-time team member, has taken years. Her journey began when an unexpected opportunity enabled her to escape her traffickers and call the police. The law enforcement officers who rescued her then connected her with A21, and we helped her to begin her long, painful journey of healing. Little by little, she walked through fears rooted in years of being threatened, held hostage, and used in vile ways. Little by little, she reconnected with her family and felt restored to them. Little by little, she learned how to be genuinely loved and how to trust. The hardest step of all. It didn't happen all at once, but it did happen. All these years later, I have been honored to share the platform with her multiple times as she opens her heart and shares her story with thousands. And every time, my heart is overwhelmed with the goodness of God in her life. All those years ago, traveling around the countryside of Australia, I could have never imagined any of this. I wanted to reach people and help them, but I had no idea that this would be what God had in mind. I never dreamed of rescuing victims of human trafficking. Yes, I've come a long way since that miserable night on the cot, but I got from there to here, the same way all God's children do, little by little. And wherever it is God wants me to go next, I'll get there, little by little, as well. Step by step. In God's little by little process, steps are essential for success, whether it's in our personal life, professional life, or in our spiritual and emotional development. When I started traveling through those small towns, speaking in high schools, and inviting students to nighttime events, I was taking steps. I was building on what I'd learned working with youth at church and in the youth center. Those first two steps prepared me for my work with Youth Alive. And that third step, which lasted 7 years, prepared me for the next steps. But it all began with the first step. I went to church. I said yes to serving at a cleanup day. I said yes to volunteering at the youth center. I said yes to serving as the New South Wales director of Youth Alive. I said yes to being a coordinator in the Hillsong Network. I said yes to starting Equip and Empower Ministries. I said yes to initiating A21. I said yes to launching Propel. It's not that one thing led directly to the next thing. It's that one step led to the next step, and I couldn't bypass any of the steps. It was like climbing a set of stairs, and what I learned on each step gave me the wisdom, knowledge, strength, confidence, and maturity to succeed when I moved up to the next one. Here is an example of just one way that happened. When I worked for the youth center in Sydney, before I went to serve with Youth Alive in the countryside, I started meeting with government advisors to discuss youth policies. I went to school after school, conducting seminars and working with the faculty to develop after-school programs and to write curriculum. How could I have known then that someday, through the work of A21, we would develop a curriculum called Bodies Are Not Commodities that is now distributed through schools in the United States, Mexico, Europe, Asia, and Australia? How could I have known that God would use my early years of writing and developing a local curriculum to produce a global one? God knew the end from the beginning, but I did not. God knew He was preparing me, but I did not. God knew all the unexpected moments were leading somewhere. I just trusted Him and took steps, and He has never wasted one step. The Lord directs the steps of the godly, writes the psalmist. He delights in every detail of their lives. Psalm 37, verse 23, New Living Translation. There are no express elevators to our destination, because God does not take elevators. He directs our steps. And if we're growing, little by little, He shows us just one next step at a time. I know it's not always easy. Trust me. If that night on the cot I had known all that was ahead of me, I might have packed up my bags, driven straight home, and admitted to Mum that she was right about everything, including marriage, makeup, and cooking. But God didn't overwhelm me with too much too soon. Instead, He faithfully held my hand and moved me forward one step at a time. Trusting Him for the next step has sometimes been deeply painful and difficult. So many times I wanted to skip steps, but I've seen people do that, and it always leads to a much more painful process. If we skip a step, we will still have to learn what was involved in that step. But chances are, we'll have to learn it at a higher cost and in a more public way. Personally, I'd rather learn everything I can on each step, every bit of revelation and understanding, so I don't get knocked down by the unexpected events of life ahead. I want the image of Christ to be fully formed in me. I want the fruit of the Spirit fully developed in me. I want to walk in mature love, because that is what I want to flow out of me to a lost and broken world. We simply cannot despise small beginnings or small steps. Steps keep us dependent on God. They keep us on our knees in prayer, walking by faith and not by sight. It's human nature to want to know the whole story first, to see the whole staircase from the bottom to top. But we can't possibly know the end from the beginning. I certainly didn't. Today, I fight for justice. My work routinely requires interacting with civic leaders, government officials, and law enforcement officers all outside the church. It's work I first began to be prepared for all those years ago when I worked at a non-profit youth center and learned to write government grants petitioning resources for our programs. As I sat in official meetings and submitted proposals, I was being trained to understand the inner workings of government. God was teaching me then how to work within government systems and how to interact with government officials. He was preparing me for the work of A21, but I didn't know it. Today, A21 routinely sits at the table with top government agencies and other NGOs from around the world. And its effectiveness can all be traced back to the lessons I began to learn in 1989, when I had no idea what I was doing or why. Only God knew then what I would need to know now, and He prepared me throughout the years of my youth work in Sydney and in all those little country towns. In the process, I have learned over and over that steps are necessary for growth, faith, glory, and strength. Steps are what grow a good marriage, responsible children, and fun friendship. Steps are how we regain our health and grow strong muscles. Steps are how we get from here to there, wherever there may be. The long way round. Nick is the navigator when we travel. He often uses GPS on his phone to figure out in advance exactly where we need to go once we land at an airport. I always feel so relaxed when he relies on GPS. It shows all these little red lines where the traffic is heavy and suggests alternate routes to get around the backups. It can even direct a person to the nearest coffee shop, something invaluable to my earthly existence. But sometimes Nick likes to take his own shortcut. Now, these shortcuts aren't always technically shorter, but he insists they are the way to go. And even though they stress me out quite a bit, I resign myself to the fact that there's no talking him out of it. The best thing I can do is congratulate him when they do work and utter not a word when they don't. After all these years of watching Nick navigate cities around the world and take many lengthy shortcuts, I've derived some well-thought-out spiritual principles based on our experiences with and without GPS, mostly because I've had a lot of time to think while riding in the car during all those shortcuts. Like GPS, God knows the traffic jams ahead. He knows the road closures and the accidents blocking the way. So He reroutes us the way He knows is best for us. Instead of letting us take a misguided shortcut, He leads us little by little, step by step, the long way around. When God first led the children of Israel out of Egypt, He knew the route that would best prepare them to live and thrive in the promised land, and it wasn't a shortcut. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. For God said, if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by the desert road toward the Red Sea. Exodus chapter 13, verses 17 to 18. Rather than leading them on an established trade route that was hundreds of miles shorter than the one they took around to the Red Sea, God led the children of Israel on the long desert road. He knew the Philistines were an aggressive people and that if the Israelites were attacked, they might turn back. God knew they still had a slave mentality, not a warrior mentality. For centuries, they had been workers and builders. They had never learned how to fight, so they weren't ready for combat. Before they could conquer and possess the promised land, they had to become warriors. God had to renew their minds to think like military generals and soldiers. Until He could do that, He kept them from facing enemies and war. God knew the long way around was for their good, just like it's always for our good too. When I was on that cot crying and doubting that I was in the right place at the right time, all I could see were my peers who had graduated from Bible college and stepped right onto the teams of so many great churches. I can't imagine how much worse the temptation to play this comparison game would have been if I had social media and spent my evenings keeping up with posts of their seemingly picture-perfect lives. It was already hard enough to not dwell on questions like, God, why are we taking the long way round? Why did they get a shortcut to all the best jobs? Why don't I get a shortcut? The answer was that God had a different future for me, and I wasn't ready for it yet. I wasn't strong enough, and God wanted to build my muscles. So he used the pressures and challenges of my work to mature me, to increase his anointing and power within me. He forged me in the fire. My job was to embrace the process rather than run from it, to keep my feet on the long road. Friend, the same principle applies to all of us. Even when there is a tempting shortcut, there is never a substitute for the long way around. God uses the desert roads of our lives to protect us and to prepare us. Sometimes our long road takes the form of anonymity, obscurity, long hours, or uncomfortable conditions. It's that place where we think, whatever God had for me, I've missed it. Or I feel parched and empty and far from God. Or I've blown it, and now God has no use for me. Or I thought God gave me a dream and a promise, but maybe I got it all wrong. Long roads are also where the waiting can wear us down and dim our hopes. We wait years and pray fervently for the salvation of a loved one, healing in our marriage, breakthrough in our struggles, an open door to our dreams, all to no avail. On the long road, sometimes all we can think is, God, have you forgotten me? God has taken me on many a long road, and I've had all of these discouraging thoughts and more at one time or another. I started walking one long road nearly 20 years ago in South Africa. I saw satellite dishes everywhere, on every rooftop, even in areas of abject poverty, and I realized how many more people I could reach with a message of faith and hope through television. I wanted to create a Christian program right then, but it took almost 2 decades, the long way round, before I first stepped into a studio to tape my own show, Equip and Empower. During those long road years, God was preparing me so I could use this powerful tool effectively. Who knows, if I had started 20 years ago, I might have run out of material in the first month. But now, I know it is the perfect time for me to use broadcasting to make the name of Jesus known around the world, and I certainly have plenty of messages to share. Was the long road hard and discouraging? Yes, and yes. But I'm so glad I never hosted my own program until now. God was never withholding it from me. He had placed the desire in my heart in the first place. Rather, he was preparing me. He was renewing my mind, maturing me, and making me stronger so that when I did step into my dream, I was prepared to handle it well. God planted the idea of a television show in my mind years before I could step into my own program. And I imagine he has planted ideas and dreams in your mind and heart as well. A book you want to write. An invention you hope to patent. A house you dream of building. A business you want to launch. A family you want to raise. A difference you want to make. If you have a dream, then chances are you're on a long road, which means sooner or later, the enemy will mess with you and tempt you to take a shortcut. In those times, you simply must trust that God is protecting you and preparing you because he is always for you, never against you. And he's not only for you, he's gone on before you. How do I know? Read this charge that Moses leveled against the Israelites. In spite of this, you did not trust in the Lord your God, who went ahead of you on your journey, in fire by night and in a cloud by day, to search out places for you to camp and to show you the way you should go. Deuteronomy chapter 1, verses 32 and 33. God is always out ahead of his people. The problem with the Israelites and with us is a lack of trust. Don't repeat the Israelites' mistake. Trust that God is always way ahead of you, protecting you from something you can't see or aren't yet prepared to handle. A destructive relationship, a toxic work environment, a ruinous business partnership, a tragedy of epic proportions, a big responsibility. In every area of my life, the long way around with Jesus, as my GPS, has always proven better than any shortcut I could have taken without Jesus. I can't tell you how many times Nick's shortcut doubled the distance and the time of our trip. That's not what God wants for our life journeys. Jesus is our tried and true GPS, and we don't want to tune him out to gamble on a shortcut. I'm here to stay. Wherever you are on your journey, keep going. If you're making gains in incremental small steps, trust God that you're on track. I'm so thankful for the long way around in my life. I'm so thankful for all he saved me from and for all he prepared me to do. All those years ago, my friends couldn't understand the path I was on. Christine, what are you doing? Why are you involved in youth center work? Why are you involved in government? Why are you involved in social justice? It didn't make any sense to my friends, or sometimes even to me, but it made perfect sense to God. He knew my destiny. What they thought was holding me back, my commitment to my local church and its vision for youth, was exactly what prepared me to touch more of the world. When I was working with kids traumatized and addicted to drugs, kicked out of school, locked up in juvenile centers or prisons, living in foster care, God was preparing me for all the vulnerable people I would someday reach through the work of A21. When I was speaking in high school gyms, sometimes to only 20 teens, he was preparing me to speak in stadiums filled with tens of thousands of young adults. When I was orchestrating citywide events in small towns, he was teaching me how to organize and plan large events in public venues. He knew Propel events were in my future. When I drove long distances working for Youth Alive, an organization that flourishes to this day, he was preparing me for a lifetime of travel around the world. Sleeping on a cot in a room with three kids was just preparation for what was to come. Like when I traveled for 3 months while suffering from morning sickness, and then learned how to breastfeed in airports, change diapers anywhere I could find a flat surface, and race through terminals with a stroller. Oh, and this. There was the time I was speaking, heard a baby cry in the audience, and my milk came flowing in. That, of course, has nothing to do with traveling, but it was a memorable motherhood experience I'll never forget. When I first started speaking to women's groups in local churches, God was preparing me for women's conferences globally and for Propel. He was preparing me to grow into a teacher of the Word and of leadership principles based on the Word. That's the assignment that has surprised me the most. I could see from the beginning that I was an evangelist, that I was created to win souls of every age. But I didn't expect to teach the Word and inspire leaders. I didn't expect to activate women to realize their leadership potential. But every unexpected step had a purpose in helping me fulfill my calling, in helping me step into more and more of my destiny. I don't know what God has placed in your heart to do, but I know that he has a journey planned out for you, and he's never forgotten you. Let's determine today to keep taking steps as he faithfully leads us through the expected and unexpected ones alike. Let's trust that he is out ahead of us and that he will use every single one of our steps for our good and for his purposes. Let's anchor ourselves to the promise that he will use every moment of our lives to make us stronger and wiser, more tender and compassionate, more loving and giving, all for his glory. Let's keep embracing the adventure of faith and moving forward little by little, step by step, even when he leads us the long way around. Chapter 9. When the unexpected calls for change. Letting go of limitations. No matter what, expect the unexpected. And whenever possible, be the unexpected. Linda Barry. Stepping out onto the porch, coffee in one hand, phone in the other, I thanked God for another beautiful Southern California morning. The sky was a vibrant blue, with not a cloud to be seen, and the ever-so-faint scent of hibiscus hung in the air. Crawling into our hammock, a favorite place where I love to pray and talk with God, I relaxed, taking in a rare moment with no one else at home. Everything felt so quiet and peaceful, both on the patio and inside of me. Everything felt well with my soul. Nick had taken the girls out for a while for what I felt sure was an errand for tomorrow's Mother's Day celebration. Their mysterious whispers and hushed giggles in the hall were my first clue. But finding both a preteen and teenage girl out of bed and dressed before noon on a Saturday was the real giveaway. Nick, Catherine, and Sophia each gave me an all-too-purposeful goodbye, one at a time, while giving each other silly grins as they headed out to the garage. I couldn't help but smile as I thought about how funny the three of them could be, especially when they were up to some kind of covert, top-secret gift-giving mission. As I lay there, absorbing the quiet, it dawned on me that it was already Sunday in Australia, which meant it was already Mother's Day there. I instinctively opened my phone and went to my favourites list. And then, in the split second it took to reach her name and almost tap it, I froze. What was I thinking? Mum wasn't there. She couldn't be. And she would never be there again. It felt as though the bottom fell out of my heart and my stomach at the same time. I felt chilled, then flushed, then overcome, and then profoundly empty. What followed next was the most unexpected, uncontrollable, raw emotion that I had felt in years. Wave after wave of sheer grief filled my chest, emptying in explosive sobs I couldn't control. As much as I tried to stop it, or even to slow it down, all I could do was curl into a fetal position and convulse with it. Mum had always been a phone call away, and I had always called her, no matter where I was in the world. When I needed a good laugh, when I just wanted to hear what was going on in our family, when I wanted to update her on Catherine and Sophia and all their latest shenanigans, when it was Easter, Thanksgiving, Christmas, her birthday, or Mother's Day. I always called, and she called me. It had been 7 months since my brother George had helped her FaceTime with me on my birthday, when her last words to me were, "I love you." 7 months since the night of my 50th birthday party, when I'd missed multiple calls from my brother Andrew, and then one text saying simply, "Mum is gone." 7 months since our family had flown to Sydney, and we all had laid her to rest next to my dad. Tumbling out of the hammock, partially bent over, I stumbled into the house. As I got a drink of water and washed my face, I hoped to somehow untangle the knot in my stomach and settle my broken heart. But I couldn't. All that I could focus on was how unexpected all of this was. How out of left field all this was. I had grieved at her funeral when we were all together, so why was it happening again, and so deeply? My mind went to all the pictures I had brought home from Mum's house, the ones she had promised to parcel out for us but never did. I had retrieved them from her bedroom closet a couple of days after her funeral, when my brothers and I and our families all met at her house to sort through her things and start preparing her home for sale. I had promised George and Andrew that I would take on the task of grouping all her photos for each of our families as best as I could. Perhaps that would be a way to get a handle on my emotions and accomplish something constructive at the same time. The unexpected photo. After finding where Nick had stacked the boxes in the garage, I put a few on the floor and sat down to begin categorizing their contents. There were 78 years of captured memories to sort, and even more that Mum had inherited from our grandparents and great-aunts and uncles. Opening the first box, I took a deep breath, trying to fortify myself against the barrage of grief that most certainly awaited me. As I picked up the first photo, I found myself staring at a picture of my dad. He looked just like I remembered him, always handsome. It was a black-and-white print, just like the one Mum had kept in a frame on her nightstand for the last 32 years, ever since he died. I imagined her telling him goodnight in the evenings, talking out all the issues of life with him, telling him about all the grandkids he'd never met, eventually telling him she'd see him soon. What a reunion she and my dad must have had. I had always been proud of how she had found a way to pick up the pieces after he had died, even though I knew she never let go of him in her heart, that he never stopped being the love of her life. I caught myself smiling through tears just thinking of the two of them together again. Setting my dad's picture aside, I pulled out a handful of black and white photos. They were so old, so fragile. I quickly recognized them as ones that had been passed down to Mum from her parents. I set them in a lid and left them untouched for fear they would crumble to pieces. As I went through box after box, all the images revealed the timeline of our family history. There were photos of Mum where she grew up in Egypt. There were photos of her on a ship headed to Australia. She was only 16 at the time, a year older than Catherine was now. Her parents only had enough money to put her and her sister and brother on a ship while they stayed behind. The plan was for my mum to work and save up enough money to send for them. And she did. I couldn't imagine being 16 and having to leave all your family and friends to get a job in a strange land, to carry the weight of such a responsibility. Mum had been extremely courageous, but getting her to talk about that part of her life was next to impossible. There was so much my family never talked about. There were photos of my mum and dad's courtship and wedding. My dad loved to tell the story of how he was engaged to another woman when the two of them came to Australia. When they broke up soon after, he was introduced to my mum through a mutual friend. He always said God used the other woman to bring him to Australia so he could meet the love of his life. There was a box of all our childhood school pictures. What is it with school pictures? Why does everyone always have to look so awkward? Going through them all, trying to put them in chronological order, I wanted to see how all three of us had changed throughout the years. In each of mine, I found myself looking into my own eyes as though I was searching for something, and I found it. Someone else might never have noticed it, but I could. I could see the little girl who had learned to hide so much. I could see all the pain behind all those crooked smiles. There were so many photos, so many events. When Dad got a new car, when Andrew lost a tooth, when George graduated from high school, pictures of Mum and me, and lots of cousins. Our family loved any excuse to party, eat, and dance, so birthdays always involved countless cousins and grand festivities. My favorite decade was the 1970s. Everyone looked hilarious in psychedelic shirts, foot-wide bell-bottoms, and platform shoes. I cannot believe the clothes my mum dressed me in. How many colors can one person wear at a time? And then there was my permed hair in the 80s. What was all that about? And the taffeta dresses I had to wear at every formal occasion. Greek mothers were obsessed with dressing their daughters in taffeta. Green, red, blue, every color in the rainbow. I have an aversion to shiny, itchy, crunchy fabric to this day. The whole photo sorting experience was strange. So strange. Filled with unexpected emotions. One moment I was laughing hysterically, and the next I was crying from the depths of my heart. Minutes filled with gratitude gave way to moments of crippling pain. That's how grief works. That's how unexpected and unpredictable it is. I wasn't entirely sure my idea of going through the photos was a good one, but now that I had started, I wanted to keep going. Reaching for the next box, I flipped off the lid, and lying on top was a photo I hadn't seen in decades. It was one of Mum, the only one of Mum, pregnant. I had seen it as a child, once I think, but I never knew which of us she was carrying at the time. When I asked Mum about that photo, she moved me along, avoiding any kind of clear answer. But Mum was always that way, vague, deflective, and uncomfortable when we asked about our start in life. She never even wanted to go through photos together when I was growing up, and when I grew old enough to be curious and ask questions about being pregnant, like whether she felt sick when she was pregnant, or what was it like to have a baby, she redirected every conversation. I had grown up in a home full of love and full of secrets. Everyone in my extended family knew that George and I were adopted. Even the neighbors knew, but George and I didn't know. My parents never mentioned it. It wasn't until I was 33 and George was 35 that we learned the truth. It was devastating to both of us, but over time we came to understand my parents' reasoning, though it was still painful. They felt that by not telling us they were protecting us, loving us and providing us a safe cocoon to grow up in. Still, it was hard to think that everyone knew but us for decades. When I went home for Mum's funeral, I visited her lifelong neighbor and best friend of 45 years, Carmel. As we talked and comforted each other, she retold a story that I cherish to this day. She said that my grandmother was the one who had taken the call from the hospital, letting our family know a baby had been born and was up for adoption. As the story goes, my grandmother ran outside shouting to Carmel and my mother, who were enjoying tea in the backyard, "We have a girl! We have a girl!" Hearing that story all over again made me feel so loved. As I sat there holding that photo, seeing how happy my mum looked, I couldn't help but smile. It was Andrew she was carrying, and I was glad she got to give birth to one of us, especially after accepting that she would never be able to have a child of her own. How wonderful for her to have such an unexpected surprise. I can imagine what a shock it must have been for both her and my dad. Scooting myself back against the garage wall, I closed my eyes and focused on just one thing, exhaling. I was utterly drained, yet also glad for all the reminiscing. Deep down, for some reason, I knew I needed to be doing this now, and not 7 months before when Mum had died. Timing is just as important as doing when it comes to following God. Even if I didn't see any of this grief coming, working through it was exactly what God had planned for me. In my mind, I could still see the picture of Mum pregnant with Andrew, and my thoughts drifted into thinking about what my biological mother might have looked like when she had carried me. Somehow, I couldn't imagine her as happy as Mum looked in this photo, especially since she felt the need to give me up. I hadn't thought of her in years, but I found myself wondering if she ever thought of me, if she ever wondered what had become of me. That's when I felt an ache, a deep ache, settle into me. The unexpected grief. For the next 2 weeks, while trying to put so much of my heart and so many of my thoughts onto the pages of this book, I experienced waves of unexpected grief. It was so acute at times, I felt as though my heart might rip in two. As I kept trying to sort through my feelings and memories, my mind kept returning to that picture of Mum pregnant, and I couldn't help but think of my birth mother, again and again and again. Somewhere in the midst of it all, it hit me. Maybe there is more to this than just grieving Mum. Perhaps now that Mum was gone, it's time to dig further into who my birth mother is. We never know when God will use an unexpected event to trigger something in us, to extend an invitation to come to Him, to deal with something that has remained dormant and untouched in our heart for years. Deep down, though I had no real understanding yet, I knew I had stumbled onto something, and I asked God to help me. Little did I know He was about to take me on another unexpected journey. Not long after Mother's Day, we had friends over for dinner. In the course of our conversation, they shared how their adopted son went through a period of questioning and searching, and that a counselor who specialized in family of origin issues had helped tremendously. Never had I heard of such a person. A Christian family of origin counselor? What did that mean? Our friends explained that the counselor had more than 20 years of experience helping people piece together clues from their past to better understand the present. After the emotional upheavals of the past couple of weeks and feeling consumed by so many thoughts about my birth mother, I was intrigued. My friends had no idea what I had been going through, but God knew. At many times in my life when I needed information, understanding, and answers, God had led me to someone who could help. He was at it again, and as always, His timing was perfect. The right person, at the right time, with the right connection to the next step. I knew that God had no intention of exposing a tender place in my heart without wanting to heal it. Listening to our friends share what a help this counselor had been to their family, and now that Mum was gone, I felt a sense of release to go in search of more details. After all these years, though I knew various facts about my birth mother's life, it seemed that it was time to dig a little further into who she was, and perhaps how that had affected who I had become. And after 2 weeks of being ambushed by episodes of grief, I knew I didn't want the acute pain of heartbreak to become chronic. Hope stirred in me that God was leading me to the right person to pursue this journey with me. An unexpected connection. When I arrived at my first appointment and the counselor invited me in, I took the seat she offered me close to the windows. I found being there oddly comforting. It's always hard to reveal your private thoughts to a complete stranger, but this woman was skilled at making people feel safe. She was willing to unpack whatever mystery those who came to see her were trying to unravel, and for that, I was grateful. I felt sure that I was in the right place at the right time. As I began laying out medical records and social work documents, I had brought pieces of my past I hadn't shared with anyone in years. She assured me that we would explore whatever was there to be uncovered. Over the course of the next few visits, the counselor proved to be the wise and perceptive guide my friends had described, and more. It was clear from her years of experience that she knew how to read between all the lines of information I had given her. She described patterns of behavior for me to contemplate, and during one appointment, she dropped a bombshell of perspective I had never considered. "Christine, do you realize that your biological mother was quite probably exploited by your father, and here you are rescuing women around the world from being exploited as well? Your mother was 23, and your father was a 55-year-old successful businessman with a wife and family. He was more than 3 decades her senior, old enough to be her father. From my years of experience, I guarantee that this wasn't his first indiscretion. The records indicate that she lived in immigrant housing and had only an elementary school education. Do you realize how all that made her extremely vulnerable and at risk?" As I sat listening to her initial assessment of the documents I had given her, I was stunned. Never would I have theorized that my birth mother was possibly exploited, just as vulnerable as the women A21 reaches out to every day. I had always pictured her as scared, alone, and ashamed when she carried me, but never had I thought of her as a potential victim, as someone similar to the women I'm called to help. "Whether their relationship was consensual or not," she continued, "whether they met once, twice, or more, your mother most likely was looking for a father figure, affection, protection, or provision. Or maybe all of them. He was in a position of power and strength. And the fact he wasn't at your birth and that his name isn't on your birth certificate shows that she was left to fend for herself." For the first time in my life, I felt compassion for my birth mother, almost the same kind of tenderness I had in my heart for my mum. It was entirely unexpected. A depth of empathy I hadn't known before, and on some distant level, perhaps love. How could I love a woman I had never met? I felt protective of her. I wanted to reach back in time and help her, to stand with her, and to let her know that she was not alone. In years past, I had thought of what it might have been like for her to arrive at the hospital and go through the birthing experience all on her own. I had imagined that she felt shame, and perhaps she had carried that heavy burden throughout her entire life. But I had never put so many concepts together all at once. And until that moment, I had never felt such mercy. I couldn't help but begin formulating an image of her that resembled the women rescued through the work of A21. How many times had I sat with them, listened to them, and grieved over their vulnerabilities as women who were lured with promises of a better present, a more hopeful future, if only they complied with some scheme that trapped them in a place they never intended to be. However you evaluate it, Christine, it was a very unequal relationship. He manipulated her. He took advantage of her. Even though I had no way of knowing exactly what happened, the realization that my birth mother was just as at risk of being exploited as the women I help rescue was astounding. To wrap my mind around the idea that a woman so vulnerable gave birth to me, someone who fights against the very injustices this woman might have experienced, strengthened my purpose, my resolve. I couldn't reach back in time to help my birth mother, but I could remain faithful to the work of A21 and press on to help those still needing to be rescued. Yes, always, today, every time you ask. It was difficult to sort through all the emotions this one revelation evoked in me. Our relationships with our mothers are deeply complex, and mine was even more so. But I know where my help comes from. So, as is my custom, I turned to Jesus and his word. I needed his understanding, and I was confident he wanted to show me something. Opening my Bible with my journal at hand, I began reading in John 5, where I had left off the day before. Now there is in Jerusalem, by the sheep gate, a pool, in Aramaic called Bethesda, which has five roofed colonnades. In these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. John chapter 5, verses 2-5, English Standard Version. For longer than Jesus had been alive, this man had lain under one of five porches surrounding the pool, where the poor, marginalized, sick, lame, and blind had gathered together in hopes of being the first one in the pool each time the water stirred. As legend said, the first one in would be healed. For 38 years, this man had felt helpless to move or to change, destined to be at the mercy of everyone else. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be healed?" John chapter 5, verse 6, English Standard Version. The words jumped off the page at me. "Do you want to be healed?" I couldn't help but laugh aloud. "Jesus, you cannot be serious. I am healed. I wrote a book called Unashamed. How much more could there possibly be? We've dissected every part of my being, every chamber of my heart, and put it out there for the whole world to read. I just wanted to explore more about my birth mother, not be turned inside out again." But the words continued to resonate in my heart. "Do you want to be healed?" I had been here before, enough times to know that there would be greater fruitfulness on the other side, great reward that would be exceedingly abundantly beyond what I could ask or think, just as he promises. Enough times to know the way up is always down, the way out is always in. Enough times to know that he always works deeper in me before working more broadly through me when he's preparing to impact more people. "Yes, Lord, I want to be healed. Always, today, and every time you ask me in the future." I knew this wouldn't be the last time he asked me, because there is always more. More healing, more wholeness, more intimacy with Jesus, and more effectiveness for Jesus. There is always more transformation, more sanctification, and more freedom. Sometimes embracing this more means going deep and cutting some things out, much like I shared in Unashamed. Other times, embracing more is akin to examining scar tissue or finding a bruise that needs tending, like it was for me in this season. But no matter the depth of our wounds, God's promise to us stands. He heals the brokenhearted and binds up their wounds. Psalm 147, verse 3. Every time Jesus has invited me into more healing, it has been unexpected. No matter how many times his invitation has come, no matter how many times I have taught about it, I can still get caught off guard. I can feel just like the man lying by the pool called Bethesda, surprised by an unexpected question. When Jesus met him, Jesus didn't help him move to the edge of the pool or give him money for food like we might expect. No, Jesus asked a question that went straight to the heart. "Do you want to be healed?" Now I have to pause and laugh at Jesus' poor pastoral care skills. Every church has a pastor who visits the sick in the hospital, and I'm sure that if he, she made a habit of asking, "Do you want to be healed?" a reassignment would be just over the horizon. You can't be the pastoral care leader and have zero bedside manner. I'm sure the training manual for hospital visitation clearly indicates how to approach the sick, and I seriously doubt that Jesus' blunt question with an insultingly obvious answer is on the list of suggested conversation starters. But as always, Jesus had a purpose. Just as he had a purpose when he used the grief I felt for my mum to lead me to tender places in my heart for my birth mother, he was digging deeper, actually asking the afflicted man for more. Do you really want things to change? Are you willing to take on all the responsibilities that will become a regular part of your life if I heal you? Jesus wasn't just asking the man if he wanted to be healed physically, but if he wanted to be healed completely. He wasn't asking him a one-time question, but a lifelong one. Jesus knows it's so easy for us to grow accustomed to our limitations, to be defined by them, to make allowances for them, and not really want to pay the price of change. He knows how easy it is for us to settle for where we are and to live a smaller life than what he's called us to. When he asked me, "Do you want to be healed?" he was asking me to go beyond where I had been healed before, beyond all the rejection and abandonment I had been healed from and had detailed in Unashamed. He was asking me to go with him to another level. Isn't that what he does with all of us? When we cry out, wanting to be married, doesn't it stand to reason that his response might be an unexpected question? Are you ready for the vulnerability and transparency of being in a relationship? Or when we pray for new friends, might he ask, are you willing to risk and invest your time and your heart without any guarantees? We cry out to him, wanting to move forward. But how would we answer if he asked us, do you want to let go of the past once and for all, including forgiving all the people who have wounded you? Are you willing to do the work of uncovering bitterness and uprooting it altogether? Are you willing to give up trying to control every facet of your life and make more room for me? I know that saying yes to Jesus' unexpected questions might be hard, but saying yes is always the way forward. It's so easy to settle for where we are, to get comfortable with things as they are. It's so easy to get stuck. Stuck. That's the condition the man's answer to Jesus' question exposed. When asked by Jesus if he wanted to be healed, the man didn't say, yes, finally, are you kidding me? Of course I do. Who wouldn't want to be healed? He said, sir, I have no one to put me in the pool when the water is stirred up, and while I'm going, another steps down before me. John chapter 5, verse 7, English Standard Version. Do you see what he did there? Go back and read it again. When Jesus offered him freedom, the man focused on his limitations. He was so consumed by his problem that he couldn't embrace the miraculous possibility literally staring him right in the face. When Jesus poses his unexpected question to us, we have a choice to make. We can focus on our limitations and problems, or embrace the miraculous possibility he offers us. We can run away saying aloud no, or run forward proclaiming aloud yes. When Jesus asked if I wanted to be healed, I could have dismissed it or offered an excuse. I could have busied myself, compartmentalized my emotions, and refused to go there in my heart, justifying my decision in a multitude of ways. But, unlike the man by the pool, I knew the value of healing. I knew that there would be more freedom waiting for me on the other side. I knew that my healing wasn't just about me, that there were people to reach beyond myself. So I said yes. It is easy to focus on our limitations instead of our freedom, to be consumed with our pool problem instead of with the hope of Jesus' healing. It's easy to pass up his invitation to be so focused on everything that's wrong that we are incapable of seeing the miracle Jesus offers us. It's easier to keep our eyes fixed on our limitations. I didn't go to the right school. I don't know how to do anything else. I don't have enough education. I'm trapped in this town. I didn't come from a wealthy family. I have no trade, no skills. I don't know where to start. All that man had ever known was his infirmity. His pain and place of limitation were his comfort zone. Instead of saying an enthusiastic yes, he placed blame on others for his plight and held onto his condition. It's incredible, isn't it? But the truth is, we've all been there. We've all done that. We've clutched the reasons why we can't fulfill our purpose. We've held onto our anger or disappointment, unforgiveness or offense, bitterness or rejection, addiction or greed. We've all found ways to adapt to our brokenness instead of risking the responsibilities of wholeness. It's much easier for us to post and hashtag about being wounded than it is to take the risk of being healed. How many times have we stayed right where we were and blamed someone or something else for our misery? Our spouse or children? Our co-worker or boss? How many times have we believed that being stuck wasn't our fault? And all the while, God was showing us the way out. When the man dodged Jesus' direct question, Jesus simply ignored his response and issued a command. Get up, pick up your mat, and walk. At once, the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. John chapter 5, verse 8. Think about this for a minute. If you've been lying on a mat for 38 years, what does that mat represent to you? How would you feel if someone tried to take it from you? Can you imagine your life without it? That mat was the man's security and perhaps the only source of comfort he had ever known. So when Jesus commanded the man to get up and pick up his mat, he wasn't just healing his body. He was challenging his sense of safety. He was also challenging the source of his identity as a helpless victim. That was what was behind Jesus' question from the beginning. Not just, do you want to be healed? But, are you willing to give up this old identity for a new one? Are you willing to give up your limitations for freedom? Your victimhood for victory? Your blaming for owning? Your disappointments and bitterness for grace and forgiveness? Get up, pick up your mat, and walk. When Jesus healed him, the man had been lying by a pool called Bethesda, a name that literally means house of mercy in Hebrew or house of grace in Aramaic. When Jesus healed the man, he ministered to him both mercy and grace. When Jesus heals us, he extends to us the same mercy and grace, and he wants us to receive it with open arms. He wants to help us to get to the place where in every area of our lives and hearts, we come to realize what God has done for us is bigger than what others have done to us. Where what God has said about us is greater than what others have said about us or to us. Do you want to be healed? Is a question that Jesus asks over and over again throughout our lives. And he always wants our answer to be yes. Another unexpected invitation. I'm aware more than ever that nothing can change the events that got me on the mat in my life. That nothing can change how I was birthed by one woman and adopted by another. But I know mercy and grace are what got me up and walking. And mercy and grace are what have continued to open doors of destiny in my life. When Jesus extended an invitation to me for more healing, he exposed mother wounds I didn't even know were there. In his great mercy and compassion, he wanted to help me. When I went back in time to explore more about my birth mother, I found another place in my heart where I was lying on the mat. And when I did, I said yes to Jesus, picked up my mat, and walked again. I'm so glad it wasn't the first time he'd asked me if I wanted to be healed of something, and I'm certain it won't be the last. At this stage of my life, because I've walked through so much and been healed of so much, it's more of an expected question than an unexpected one. And I want it. I want my next season of life, of marriage, motherhood, and ministry to be even more fruitful than the last. I don't want to miss anything God has intended for me, and I know He doesn't want me to miss anything either. Not long after I walked through this process, God did something very special for me. It felt like He just gave me the biggest smile, an unexpected gift that touched me so deeply. I opened my email to find an invitation to Mumbai, India. I was to be honored with the Mother Teresa Memorial Award for Social Justice on behalf of A21 for our work around the world rescuing slaves. An award in the name of Mother Teresa,